This is Selling the Truth, a podcast documentary brought to you by WF360 Productions. This is the story of a news media company caught in the ferment of current political and technological change. Its location is itself symbolic, Hong Kong, where democratic freedoms confront China's 2021 national security law. Intriguingly, this story has remained almost hidden in plain sight, while the clampdown on other media outlets in Hong Kong has made global headlines. We are looking at the South China Morning Post. To understand where we are today, this episode listens to the key architect of the project at its inception in 2017. His appointment was itself both imaginative and surprising.
Tell me another traditional company that would be so bold as to make such an interesting choice as hiring someone who's not a news media traditional professional, but someone who's completely from Silicon Valley and thinks completely differently. I mean, it's a very courageous choice.
That is Ben Abbotts, an executive at SEMP, and he's talking about Gary Liu, SEMP's CEO. I am your host, Susan Bird, and this is Selling the Truth, Episode 2, The Reluctant Hero. In Episode 1, Gary explained his audaciously big mission. Imagine you're 33 and Alibaba makes you CEO of a venerable institution, Hong Kong's newspaper of record, the South China Morning Post. Where do you start? As you've heard, Gary wasn't there to improve things. He was expected to totally transform this paper into a global media company. And the mission behind it all, besides transforming the SEMP into a digital powerhouse, was to make it the vehicle for leading the conversation about China globally, starting with the United States. This adventure is so awash with challenges, almost everyone dismissed it as mission impossible. Too tough to turn around an entrenched institution. Too difficult to catch up with other companies further ahead in integrating digital into their newsrooms. And too problematic to remain editorial independent while owned by a giant Chinese company. So what was this nice young American doing moving to Hong Kong to take on this monster job? Well, for Gary, it was more than a business venture. It went way deeper. Whether by design or not, Alibaba had recruited a man whose own identity crossed cultures.
This was without a doubt very, very personal for me. If you were to ask me who I am, what I am, I would say that I'm Asian American. The reality is that I am the son of Taiwanese parents who has grown up in the Western world. I grew up in a combination of New Zealand and the United States, born a U.S. citizen, but have lived in multiple different cultures since then. The last 20 years of my life have been in the U.S. Northeast. And having been raised in a very, very Asian culture, yet having grown up surrounded by two very different expressions of Anglo-Saxon culture, there's always been a very personal tension that I felt, which is why the way I see the world is hard to reconcile with the way people around me see the world. Why is it that the understanding that ostensibly should be there because we're much more of a global village at this point, why is that understanding still not quite complete? So to be able to come here, join this company right at the start of this transformation, and be able to participate in this larger goal of helping foster that better understanding between East and West, very specifically between Western culture and China, that's something that's extremely personal. So yes, this decision was not only call it once in a lifetime, certainly right now, very few of these opportunities exist in this industry. For me, it was extremely personal.
So who is Gary Liu? Can he supercharge 1,000 employees into believing that they can carry out Mission Impossible? And how will he go about doing it? To find out, I started with lunch with Zhou Tsai, Alibaba's co-founder and vice chair. In fact, Alibaba's second largest individual shareholder after Jack Ma. He's Taiwanese-Canadian, carries passports from both countries, and his residence is San Diego, California. Zhou Tsai is a Yale Law School grad. He left his job at a top New York law firm to join Jack Ma at a salary of $50, I'm told, to build Alibaba from scratch. They started by working out of Jack's apartment. Now a multi-billionaire, Joe leads Alibaba's strategic acquisitions and investments, including the SEMP purchase. So, no surprise, he's the chair of SEMP's board of directors. I can appreciate just how valuable Joe's perspective would be to Gary. Joe is wicked smart, but modest, with a sense of calm. He has elevated active listening to an art form, always believing there's something he can learn from you. Sometimes I'm told he even takes notes in casual conversations. He's put together tons of deals for Alibaba, and he lives and breathes tech. So I asked Joe the obvious question. Why Gary Liu?
Well, Gary was the dark horse candidate. When we first drew up the job description, we said to ourselves, well, this person needs to have tons of experience managing a big business and all the managerial skills, as well as the sensitivity of culture and all of that. And Gary grew up in New Zealand and spent most of his educational years in the United States and working years in the U.S. So he, on paper, it didn't seem like he was the right fit. He doesn't have a journalist background, even though he has run a news aggregation service, right? He has experience doing that. He's young, but the more we talk to Gary, the more we're convinced that he's the right guy.
Initially, two others had interviewed Gary via Skype. Despite or perhaps because of Gary's nonconformity, they convinced Joe to follow up with Gary personally.
They could have written off Gary very easily. Then I had a chance to meet with Gary face-to-face for about 3 hours. We spent quite a bit of time together. And if we were to embark on this full strategy of digitizing the newspaper and distributing on social media and all that. You know, so I talked to Gary about using data insights, what are the various distribution platforms. He came to us with a 6-point plan already. He didn't presume to know everything. He was being very humble about it, but he said, hey, look, here are 6 points that I think we ought to explore in terms of improving the organization. So he had already come very well prepared for the meeting, and I thought it was a very thoughtful approach.
In other words, Gary was thinking like a CEO before he got the job. It was that proactive but humble approach that won Joe's eye and others over. Also, by virtue of who he was, Gary came with a passion to build bridges between East and West. So, in the cynical world of journalism, was this idealistic hype hiding an obvious propaganda and profit motive, or a genuine attempt to combat entrenched stereotypes? Joe gave a simple verdict.
In him, I saw the future. I saw the hope.
Joe wasn't alone in that. Despite the prevailing skepticism about the SEMP's future, some people had come to believe Gary was a kind of wunderkind who would save the day and restore to its former glory the SEMP they knew and loved. Gary, however, had no interest in being canonized nor resurrecting the past.
It's certainly easy for somebody with my profile to be arrogant in this situation because ostensibly in the way that the marketplace is telling the story is you have a guy who has spent an entire career in pure tech coming into an aged industry that is struggling to not only turn around this newspaper, but hopefully turn around the industry here in Hong Kong. That's giving me way too much credit. I don't see myself as a savior for the newspaper, nor for the industry.
The reality is that I do not look like or sound like, and on paper, I just seem like an odd candidate for this role, to be the CEO of a newspaper that has a 114-year-old history that is so important for the region and arguably for the world right now.
So it wasn't Gary's bio so much as through conversation with Gary that the Alibaba board learned first just how much tech know-how he'd picked up along the way. Without that, the SEMP, like so many other once mighty media outlets, was heading into obscurity. And second, they recognized how much he knew about effective leadership. So he got the job and moved with his wife, Katrina, a pediatric dentist, to Hong Kong. And this is where I found him in January 2017, at the helm of a company that needed to find a new way to make money and grow its readership. In episode one, Nick O'Malley, executive director of Harvard Shorenstein Center, highlighted the mountain to climb when a newspaper attempts to grow online while still trying to keep the doors open by publishing news the old way. Luckily for Gary, there was a precedent for this. I asked about the Washington Post. Could he use that as a template?
Now, the Washington Post is in a very unique and very advantageous position because Jeff Bezos has committed a significant amount of investment to the paper, which means that the Washington Post has returned back to investment mode, where they've been able to build and change not only their systems, their product, their culture, without having to focus on online profit. So they're doing the right things, what journalism should look like in today's world.
So are you guys going to be able to operate in that same fashion?
Absolutely. That is one of the reasons why this opportunity is so unique. There are a few newspapers and news organizations in the world that have the runway that the Washington Post has and that the South China Morning Post has, where bottom line profit for us is not the primary KPI that we're operating towards. Revenue is still extremely important. This is still a business that we're running, but we are in investment mode with an owner who's willing to give us the space to build, to innovate, and to change this organization so we are creating and distributing news the right way.
But wasn't Alibaba's holding the purse strings the very problem that would undermine the SEMP reclaiming its former respected, trusted glory? Critics rejected the notion the SEMP could ever be free to report the stories it really believed. Tom Grundy is a typical example. He launched Hong Kong Free Press in the wake of the city's Occupy protests and described their aim as, quote, shining a light in dark places, unquote. I asked Gary about these critical voices.
The reality is that if you are a skeptical person by nature, if you care about the independence of newspapers, and if you've seen around the world press freedoms degrading, of course, I can understand why you would look at this acquisition and wonder whether or not the source of money will affect the independence and the editorial integrity of this paper. I'm not going to fault you for considering that initially. That said, I'm here to convince you that that is not an issue at all.
In another conversation, he asserted simply, regardless of whether or not China gives us umbrage, we will be able to do the right thing. And Gary's pretty adamant here. In later episodes, you'll hear of a conversation he had with Jeff Bezos that sharpens his thinking about the tension between profitability and editorial independence. We'll be right back. Well before January 2017, Gary was thinking about the business of news and the fundamental changes he thought necessary. I asked, what had to happen in how we get our news? Gary laid it out.
It used to be that you had news on radio, news on television, or news in printed form. That simplicity is not the world that we live in, and certainly not the future. The news has fundamentally changed because of the internet. And this is a change that's been ongoing for 20 plus years. Newspapers really have only been reacting to it in the last decade, if we're being generous. We look at the world at this point as two different sets of platforms. We have the discovery platforms where people find their news and content, and the consumption platforms where they read, listen, or watch. Those two platforms and the permutations, this matrix of all these different discovery platforms, crossed with all these different consumption platforms. And every single unique combination is its own storytelling platform.
In other words, this is a labyrinth of information. We collect information at one place, but follow links that take us to completely different sites.
And the same piece of news, the same piece of content needs to be expressed differently across every single one of those options. That's not an easy thing to do. It requires technology. It also requires commitment and a creative package for each of those permutations. That is the fundamental shift that has happened.
So all these people that are getting their news from Facebook, for example, where does that fit into this whole puzzle?
Facebook is both a discovery and a consumption platform. But if you discover news on Facebook, how you consume it, the format in which you consume it, or even where you consume it, varies greatly. So take the New York Times as an example. If I were to find a New York Times article on Facebook, it is likely an article link that I click out and I land on the New York Times mobile website. But if I'm looking for an article, if I see an article by BuzzFeed on Facebook, it is very likely an instant article, which means that I discovered on Facebook the same place as I discovered that New York Times article. But when I click on it, I'm consuming it within Facebook's own frame. It's Facebook's own product. And then with Washington Post, again, the same Discovery Channel, the same title format. I discover a Washington Post article, but it could actually be a video unit. And when I press play, I'm watching it right there in the newsfeed. The same Discovery Channel, multiple different consumption platforms, multiple different consumption formats as well. So this is why it's so complex. If you were to ask what consumption behavior is really going to look like in 5 years, not to mention 10 years, anyone who tells you they know what it's going to be like is either lying or naive. So we have to be in a position structurally and with the level of investment, with the kind of technology that we can react to this changing behavior.
With Alibaba's financial heavyweight support and its commitment to significant technological change, this is one area where Gary could clearly see the SEMP's strategic opportunity.
The way that we see the world compared to a lot of these other major global newspapers is that we're willing to make big bets on user experience that hasn't fleshed out yet. Right? We know we're behind, which means that we're chasing what these other news organizations are doing today, we're going to continue being late. So we have to aim for a trajectory that is a few years down the road. So the way that we're thinking about user experience is, what is that behavior going to look like in 5 years, in 10 years? And we're going to build for that today, starting today.
So to do that, is it critical to look as far ahead as possible at future generations and their behavior and focus?
That's right. That is different. I get frustrated when I meet folks who talk about millennials and millennial user behavior. I have to remind them that the older segment of that generation is now in their mid-30s. So we're paying attention to what 28 to 35-year-olds are doing today. We're still missing the boat. We should be paying attention to 10, 11, 12, 13-year-olds and their behavior on mobile phones, because that is the predictor for what consumption behavior is going to look like for the next decade.
Do you think you may be ahead of their thinking, those other people that you were talking with?
I think we are more willing to experiment with that thinking.
So stay tuned to hear about products Gary's tech team dreams up to meet these needs of future consumers. But back in January 2017, Gary knew he had to get this ship moving and fast. Whatever new technology, new facilities, and processes were introduced, without a change in mindset and culture, the SEMP wouldn't budge. Gary had to start with the people.
The first thing that fundamentally needs to change is culture. So much of the company must transform. We need to change the way that we operate. We need to change aspects of our organizational structure. We need to change the way that we package and distribute our journalism. We need to change the way that we sell and monetize our content as well. All of this change requires us to have a culture that not only incentivizes that kind of transformation, but is fueled off of this desire to be agile, to be curious, to be passionate about the industry that we work in.
Managing external threats is one thing, but internal momentum and morale defines every organization. Gary knew this would be uphill.
At this point, a lot of the inertia that exists in our industry is actually very, very hard to overcome. So turning around the newspaper business, one that looks like the South China Morning Post does today, that is not an easy task.
So what was Gary's strategy? What he didn't do was gut or even pare down the existing workforce, as often happens when new owners take over, and he didn't bring in outside consultants for advice on what to do. Instead, starting in February 2017, his second month on the job, he gathered people leading the paper's various departments and encouraged them to see themselves as a collaborative unit, with their first task to identify just what the company stood for. What was the culture? Why did people work at the SEMP? He wanted engagement in the process from the beginning and to cultivate a sense of collaboration and inclusion. Here's how Gary tells it.
There's a lot of language around culture that's really, really important. And the way that we see culture at the South China Morning Post, it is an expression of our vision, mission, and values lived out. Our vision is why the South China Morning Post exists. Our mission is, how are we going to achieve that purpose? And our values are our base expectations of each other as colleagues and how we relate to and serve our users. The executive team, as well as a very large swath of our employee base, have been involved in defining the go-forward vision, mission, and values for the South China Morning Post Group. First of all, we got the entire company to participate in a value survey to tell us what they cared most about when it comes to the values of the company.
He's especially proud of participation in the survey.
97% of our organization submitted answers to the survey, which is incredible. So effectively, the entire company participated. That's how it started.
So he goes on.
After that, we took a senior leadership team away from the office. And for 48 hours, we focused only on trying to understand what matters for the company, what the purpose of the company is, how we're going to achieve that purpose. And then when we came back with the start of that language, with the outlines of that picture, we invited 100 of our employees across all different departments and across all different grade levels, from entry level right out of university to seasoned executives who've been in this company for literally decades. We brought 100 people together and over the course of 3 days, walked through an exercise of defining vision, mission, and values. At the end of the day, we had 15 different groups of employees go through this exercise, along with 4 different groups of executives. And across those 19 different groups, well, I was so encouraged by how close everyone's expectations for the company were. The language was so incredibly similar. It was almost exactly the same for why does SEMP exist? How are we going to reach that purpose? And those basic expectations we have for one another and for our interaction with our users. Through that exercise, people from all different departments and all different grade levels started to understand that even though our jobs might look different, our tenure looks different, our experience looks different, what we want for the company is so damn similar. So our vision, mission, and value statements came out of that exercise. And out of those 100 folks that participated in those workshops with us, I get to next week invite them to become value ambassadors for SEMP. What that really means is that they're committed to making these values not just words that are slapped on a wall or on a placard that sits on your desk, but the way that they live day in and day out within the company, the way that they treat their colleagues, the way that they treat our users. I believe that those ambassadors living these values out will create culture. And then other people will participate in that culture. Culture is going to happen with or without us. Sorry. And without us, it could lead somewhere that none of us like. But it can't be forced. The organic development of culture with these values that are guideposts, I think that is going to allow South China Morning Post to be a great place to work, a responsible and respected, incredible news organization across the globe.
And besides a culture change, what else did Gary see as critical?
We need to invest more in people, not only in number of people, especially in the newsroom. I mean, to grow the newsroom. But we also need to invest in teaching our existing employee base a new set of disciplines. And we also need to invest heavily in technology. Technology is not just consumer-facing product. A lot of it is. We need to build new kinds of consumer-facing product, integrations into the channels that we've spoken about, where our readers expect to find our news. But technology also helps supercharge our operation internally. These are the tools that our editorial team uses, that our sales and marketing team uses, to be able to make themselves more efficient, more productive.
On May 15, 4 months into the job, Gary led the SEMP town hall, gathering the entire workforce of the SEMP together. It was to become a monthly feature to launch the vision, mission, and values. I was in that audience, and it was electric.
You all with me?
It certainly looked like he was getting the commitment, at least that day, even if an undercurrent among employees was still there. We'll hear in later episodes the challenges in trying to win them over to accept the newcomers, the tech gurus, the additional journalists, all the new plans. But as a start, make no mistake, this appeared to be a triumph. Here's Brett McKeon, then head of digital content at the SEMP, with one reason Gary's town hall launch went so well.
I went there, and what I would normally have reservations about is those grumpy old print guys sitting there just sighing. But this was really different because he was quite clever that a lot of the grumpy old print guys were included as value ambassadors. And so they were won over already. These people are influencers within the newsroom. And so if they're drinking the Kool-Aid from the outset, then that has a big effect on everyone else because they were singled out, they were identified, they stood up. And that breaks down a lot of barriers or apprehension that people might have. So I thought that was a very clever tactic. Yeah. It's a level of transparency that the SEMP is very unfamiliar with. So that's cool.
Soon after this, Gary took the SEMP story on the road, including a stop in Singapore. Benson Chow, who was SEMP's Asian head of corporate communications then, reports the excitement.
He was a rock star in there. When he got off the stage, all these people were lining up to shake his hand, exchange pieces, cards, so that they can learn from him.
Rock star status or not, Gary positioned the SEMP to shake up the business of journalism, a long, arduous way to go, and unaware of the mega storms just a year or two down the line. At the time, it looked like cultural transformation was off to a good start.
One thing that I constantly not only have to remind myself of, but also my executive team, for us to succeed, we have to be humble. In fact, we have to over-index on humility. The moment we are arrogant, we'll think we have all the answers. We'll stop paying attention to our competition. We'll stop paying attention to our marketplace. We'll certainly stop paying attention to our user. And that's when we fail. We can have all of the technology expertise in-house. We can have all the money in the world and all the runway to experiment. We can have all the right partnerships. The moment we're arrogant, we collapse.
In episode 3, we'll look at the big bets on the user experience Gary talked about. You'll hear from techie hotshots who took the risk, pulled up their stakes, made their courageous choice to come join Gary. People who could build the digital backbone needed to create game-changer products that disrupt the world of journalism, particularly with the U.S. market in mind. Join us for episode 3 of Selling the Truth, playing Game 7. Thank you for listening. Selling the Truth is a WF360 production, produced by Susan Bird with help from Lori Kutz, fact-checking by Laura Kim, and sound editing from Transition Productions. Deep thanks to the SEMP employees, including tech and digital team members, reporters, and other staffers, and the many other individuals around the world who shared their candid responses to my many questions. Special thanks to Gary Liu, SEMP's CEO, for generously spending hours in conversation with me about his unique perspective on this story with worldwide significance. You can find links to more information, including supporting articles, in our show notes and on our website at WF360Productions.com. If you enjoyed this episode of Selling the Truth, tell your friends and give us a favorable review and subscribe or follow us on your favorite listening app. Your feedback will help other people discover this important conversation about journalism, news, and the truth. How we search for it, how we access it, how we consume it, and in the end, who we choose to trust to deliver it.